That, my friends, was a little sonic mastery by Casey's sound designer, Mohammed Khayzat. Yeah, he's freaking talented. On an episode like this one, he spends 10 hours soundscaping the story so it's as beautiful as possible for you. Multiply that by all of our episodes across all of our shows. Help us produce this kind of quality and become a patron of Kerning Cultures. Go to patreon.com/kerningcultures or click the link in this episode's description to support us with anything from $1 a month and up. As an independent podcast company, we depend on your support to keep producing these stories.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a podcast about the immigrant minority experience, but like in a fun way. What does that mean? Your hosts, Iranian-American Anna and Syrian-American Shireen, walk you through being a modern Middle Easterner in today's climate. They discuss growing up with immigrant parents and also tell you stories from history that will help you make sense of all the news coming out of the Middle East. Some topics the show covers include discovering sexuality within immigrant families, being raised as an outsider, stereotypes about Middle Easterners that may or may not be true, interviews with other minorities in the entertainment industry, representation in television and film, historical reporting on the Middle East, and more. Listen to Ethnically Ambiguous on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It went viral. It was everywhere.
It's very, very foreign to Arab culture to talk about personal things publicly.
12 years before that, I was under the bombs of Beirut.
I didn't go to therapy. I think I should.
This is Al Empire. Stories of exceptional Arabs around the world and their journey to the top.
Hey, I'm Hibba Fisher.
And I'm Dana Balut.
And today on Al Empire... Okay, let's start at the very beginning. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Andre Haddad. I'm a Lebanese-French-American. I was born in Beirut 47 years ago.
Andre Haddad is an entrepreneur and CEO of the peer-to-peer car-sharing company Turo. The idea behind Turo is pretty simple. You have a car, you're not always using it, so why not make some money off of it instead of just leaving it parked? Turo has raised $437 million. And Andre's previous company, iBazaar, he sold that one to eBay for $140 million.
Yeah. So I met up with Andre at a startup conference called TechWedi in San Francisco in January of 2019. And actually, this episode is made possible in part by TechWedi, which is the bridge between Silicon Valley and the Middle East. So at this conference, Andre and I found a quiet room off to the side of the event, and we started talking. What was your childhood like growing up in Beirut, and what kind of a child were you?
I had a pretty sort of non-eventful childhood in the early years before the war started.
Andre is talking about the civil war in Lebanon, which stretched a long 15 years from 1975 to 1990.
I was only 4 years old, so I can't really remember life, you know, before the war. You know, because of the war, of course, there was a lot of uncertainty. So my childhood, I would say, was typical of, you know, a Beirut kid childhood living in those years. You know, the war was not a constant feature of our lives, but there were some really challenging chapters. You know, it was sort of on and off.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Like, what kinds of challenging chapters?
See, I saw the war pretty close. You know, our home was based not very far from the green line that separated East from West Beirut for 15 years. There was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of shelling, there was a lot of destruction, there were lots of bombardments. There were different phases in the war, but it wasn't a constant level of intensity. So there were, you know, I remember certain summers, for example, where life was almost ordinary. And then there were certain summers or certain winters where, you know, we're in the midst of a very bloody chapter of the war and where we, you know, couldn't get out of our house, where we would spend our nights in the underground shelters of our building.
So what kind of child were you, though, at 12? If your mother or your father were describing you, what would they say about you?
I would say that I was probably a very introverted child with not feeling at ease in telling my parents what was on my mind. I was sort of a secretive child. I had my diary where I'd write fiction. And I think it's partly because I grew up as an only child until I was 10 years old. So I was definitely on the very introverted scale. I was also very into reading. My first little job when I was 13 was working at the local bookstore. There was a bookstore that happened to be in our apartment building. And I loved spending time in the bookstore, and I wanted to buy all the books, but I didn't have enough money to buy all these books. So one summer, I realized that I could perhaps convince the bookstore owner to hire me for the summer to help them with some administrative work when some of the employees were on vacation. So that was the first time I earned any money. And of course, all of the money I earned at the bookstore was spent in the bookstore. So my book collection just continued to increase and grow. A year later, I really got into the world and, you know, the world outside of Lebanon. I was introduced by a family member to The Economist magazine when I was 13. And I started buying every week The Economist magazine. My parents thought that was interesting. It was like they didn't expect, you know, a 13-year-old to be reading The Economist. And I just developed a lot of interest and curiosity about the world, about the economy, about the way everything works. You know, this is what got me to really love business, to start thinking about building companies myself. And ultimately, that got me into being an entrepreneur. So it had a really big impact on me.
So you always wanted to be an entrepreneur, even when you were a young teenager. Did you have a certain business or company in mind at that age that you said, when I'm older, that's what I'm going to do?
No, it was not clear at all at that point in time. I just had a lot of admiration for all the entrepreneurial stories that I was reading. But I would say I was very early, very interested in technology. You know, I had an Amstrad PC, which you've probably never heard of.
I don't know what that is.
Amstrad was a UK-based company that got quite popular in the late 70s, early 80s by selling kind of personal computers before the era of, you know, Intel and Microsoft. But it was something that got me really into technology, and I was just fascinated by all the things that could be enabled by technology.
So in 1989, I read that your family left, and that was the year when the shell hit your apartment. Mm-hmm. Can you walk me through that discussion as a family? How did you decide, you know, we've been in Lebanon enduring the civil war for 15 years, yeah, we can't anymore?
Yeah, that was a very traumatic time. We had no intention to leave, but you know, the fact that we came so close to experiencing, you know, destruction and death, I think that was the trigger point. And if I may rewind just a little bit to the summer of 1988, it was one of those episodes where life was almost normal. I was actually during that summer a radio DJ in one of the FM radios in Beirut. And during that summer, though, the most exciting event of that summer of 1988 wasn't my twice a week DJing sessions. It was actually the upcoming wedding of a cousin. So this was my cousin Samir. He had left Lebanon many years before that time. He was 30 at that time, I think, when I was 17. And we had the kinds of conversations that you never have with your parents.
His cousin Samir encouraged Andre to think about his future, about a future possibly outside of Lebanon.
So fast forward to March of 1989, when, you know, the last episode of the Civil War started, and probably the bloodiest one. That one lasted for almost 9 months. The schools were shut down. They were shut down until the month of June. There was intense shelling every day. Many, many people died on a daily basis. It was one of those such awful episodes of the war, indiscriminate shelling. All of the people who were impacted were innocent. There was, there wasn't like an army versus another army, or it was just terror. It was really terror. So it was one of the most frightening times that I certainly remember. We were staying with my grandparents. This was when our house was bombed. Our apartment building was hit by a shell. And thankfully, we were actually sleeping that night in the underground shelters that were underneath the building. So we were safe. But our apartment, which was based in the building on the fourth floor, was actually hit by the shell. And I called my cousin Samir. I told him, you remember the conversation we had last summer? He said, yes. I told him, can you help me get into a program that would get me into a business school in France? Because I think we have decided that it's probably the right time for us to move on. And he was telling me, well, you need to be ready for some sort of an exam if you want to continue your education next year in France. And at that point in time, there was no school. So I started studying on my own. So I, continued going through the program on my own. And in June, there was a little bit of a lull, a ceasefire that was declared, and schools reopened. The baccalaureate was supposed to take place in June. And of course, it did not take place in June because the schools were closed for almost 4 months. So we had a couple of months of intense studying between June and July and part of August to sit for the baccalaureate at the end of August. Got my results in early October, and mid-October I was in Paris.
And what was that plane ride over like? Do you remember what you were thinking? Yeah.
You know, I was excited and frightened at once. I was worried about all kinds of things. You know, this was the first time I was going to be living on my own without the family around me. You know, everything from finding, a place to live to, the logistics of, having a bank account in a foreign country, having a credit card, having a phone line, a lot of things that you never sort of think about when you're a child. And that, of course, comes on top of, sort of the grueling program that I was going to be part of that was sort of a competitive entrance program for the top business schools in France. The first 3 months were just incredibly tough. I was very lonely. I was not comfortable. I didn't feel like I knew how to communicate with people. Even though I spoke French very well, I didn't speak the sort of the colloquial language. And I, of course, had no real understanding of the current cultural landscape in France. So I ended up feeling very much like a foreigner and not at home. So there was no one that I could really connect with that could share some of the experiences and could help with, that transition. I was on a real budget. So I remember at that time I was living in a very, very tiny room with shared bathrooms with three other rooms. I did not have a kitchen. I just had like a sink that I could use for without sharing with others. And I didn't have a fridge, but you know, during the winter, the temperature would be very, very cold. And so I remember buying my, jug of milk and for my breakfast cereals in the morning, and then leaving the bottle of milk outside of the window in the freezing Parisian winters. My dinner menu, I think, during that era was a baguette sandwich that I would get. I would buy the baguette for like 1 franc at that time, and I would buy some cheese for another franc, and I would make myself a baguette with cheese sandwich. I don't know how I got through it. I don't think I'd be able to get through it today.
When Andre graduated, he went into consulting and then became a brand manager for Procter & Gamble in France.
At that time, I was continuing to, be even more fond of computers and technology. I had an internet connection at my place in Paris back in 1996, which was very early. It was very expensive and very slow. This was the era of the modem connections at 14K kilobits.
You'd turn it on and then go make a sandwich and come back.
Exactly. Now that I was, started to earn some money, I thought I was ready. I was ready to spend some of the money. But of course, I wanted to be, thrifty with my music expenses. So I was looking to find music cheaper than in the stores. And one night I was online and I discovered eBay. And eBay was very early back then. That was in 98. And it was only based in the US. There was no eBay anywhere else. And but they had all the great music, and there was all these used CDs that I could buy for cents on the dollar, compared to going out and buying the brand new CD in the store. There was just an incredible arbitrage opportunity because the dollar was so low compared to the French franc that when you took and there was no taxes paid, unlike CDs that you'd buy, in a store in France where you have to pay VAT, the value added tax. So net-net, including shipping costs, which were expensive, I'd be able to buy these CDs for half of the price. And they were used, but it didn't matter. What mattered to me was the music. So I started getting these boxes of CDs from sellers based in the US, and I started accumulating my CD collection, and there wasn't a great way for me to actually sell it back because I couldn't list it back on eBay.com. And that's where I thought, well, this is just an opportunity for me to, to start something similar to eBay, but in France. And I started talking about this idea with some friends, and of course, I mentioned it to my parents. They thought I was insane. They said, what do you mean strangers are going to buy stuff online, and send checks to one another in the mail? I said, yes, that's actually how it's going to work.
Hi, this is Dana. I just want to take a moment to tell you about another Kerning Cultures Network production, our flagship OG show called Kerning Cultures. The show will share stories from the Middle East and the spaces in between. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It was one of the first online classified sites in France. He called the company iBazaar, short for Internet Bazaar.
My Middle Eastern roots with bazaar, I couldn't help myself. It really is a bazaar. It was an internet bazaar. It was... it was great. You could list anything, including music, of course. So I started being a seller and a buyer, and you could sell or buy anything really online. And fast forward a couple of years, it became a really big success story.
How did you learn what you needed to build the company? How did you learn what you needed to know to build a startup?
I didn't know anything. And I made so many foolish mistakes. But it was the era where even if you didn't know, no one else knew anything. So even if you marginally knew a bit more, or if you were flexible enough or curious enough to learn, you know, you'd be ahead of everyone else. Because frankly, the rules of, building an internet business were not written at that time. My role in the early days was based on my personal experience as a user of eBay, was to provide a good understanding of what we needed to build in order to get the business started. And then when we raised some money...
How much money did you raise?
You know, we raised a whopping amount of money for that time. In 1999, our Series A, we raised 80 million French francs, which was the equivalent of $15 million.
That's incredible. How did you do that?
That's the benefit of being in the right place at the right time. So no supernatural capabilities on our part. The benefit, I think, of... those were the days of the bubble. You know, a lot of money was going to the internet. A lot of people were looking at the internet as this new El Dorado that was going to be worth billions. And we did our sort of business model, and I remember we showed numbers that showed that the business could be generating tens of millions of dollars in revenue in like year three, year four. And then you compound all of that. You get investors who, you know, might be willing to make the bet. And then I went ahead and convinced my co-founders to spend 50% of all that money on a television campaign.
Du calme!
Which was a suicidal...
Il y en aura pour tout le monde sur ebazar.fr.
Moi, Simone, je peux tout vendre et tout acheter sur Internet à des prix incroyables.
Et un téléphone, c'est possible?
Je clique sur la rubrique téléphonie.
Répondeur,
main libre,
numérique, sans fil.
It's a pretty hilarious commercial. There's a crowd standing around this older woman seated at one of those huge desktop computers from the 1990s. You know, the really big and clunky ones? And so she whistles at the crowd, gets their attention, and shows them the future, buying and selling anything online.
www.ebazar.fr. Plaisir d'enchère, plaisir d'affaires.
How did you convince your co-founders to spend half of the money that you raised on a marketing campaign, on one television campaign?
Mm-hmm.
can you put me in the moment of that conversation? You're sitting in the office around the table. You showed them a graph. What did you do?
You know, in 1999, I think only 7% of the population in France had internet access. So, you know, going after TV was in many ways ridiculous. You know, you're going to target 100% of the population. Only 7% of those have actually any internet access. So you're going to be wasting 93% of your money. And, all this math was pretty clear in everybody's heads. I think the thing that convinced everyone to move forward was we felt that competition was heating up and that we needed to differentiate in a radical way versus competition. In many ways, the software itself was not going to be very differentiated because, you know, everyone can build, even at that time, could build these kinds of features. It wasn't anything particularly complicated to build or to replicate. Idea was let's go big, let's establish the brand, and let's own this notion of buying and selling on the internet, so that anyone that comes after us, if they make any kind of noise in the same you know, space of buying and selling on the internet, people will just remember us. And, you know, it turned out to be a very successful bet because our very first TV campaign launched in October 1999. And that night we had our first TV spot, and in the middle of the 30-second spot, the website crashed. We had a massive influx of traffic. We went, I think, from a few tens of visitors to thousands of concurrent visitors, and our technology and our hardware was not really designed to support such intense concurrent usage of our website. In a short amount of time, in a year, I think we ended up having 1 million users who signed up in a year. Back in a time where, again, less than 10% of the population had internet access. So in a year, we became one of the top 5 most visited websites in France.
In that time, so a year later after you started, I read that eBay approached you to buy iBazaar. How much were they offering?
So they approached us a few times. I think the first time they approached us was in 2000, right before the NASDAQ crashed in March 2000. I think they approached us around January, February. And we were looking into raising some additional capital. You know, all these TV campaigns were quite expensive. You know, they were really interested in acquiring the business because they were looking at expanding into Europe. And so at one point, they made us an offer to acquire us for $1 billion. But we refused that offer.
Why?
Well, we thought that we thought we could be much bigger business, and we would perhaps be an independent company. We didn't necessarily think that we wanted to sell, and certainly it felt like it was still early days, in the development of the business, and we thought the business could be worth a lot more in the next 5 years, and of course we were super foolish. We had no idea what was going on. We were not really aware of the extent of the bubble and how, that was going to be the peak of that cycle. And so we end up raising another round of capital in February of 2000. We raised another $20 million. We bring in some really great investors. The valuation of the company skyrockets, and we're like, we're going to continue.
The year 2000, as you may know, was the last year of what's called the dot-com bubble. And in that year, the bubble burst.
The NASDAQ crashes, and in the ensuing 12 months, loses 50% of its value. We were running out of options. And so we sold the company to eBay for a fraction of the initial offer for $140 million, which was an amazing outcome nevertheless. Personally, I was just looking back, that was in 2001, and just 12 years before that, I was under the bombs of Beirut.
After eBay bought iBazaar, Andre stayed on working for eBay for the next 10 years, first in Europe and then in the U.S., He transitioned away from eBay in 2011, and at the time, he was based in Silicon Valley. And it was there that he heard of a new company, Turo.
So the first time I heard about Turo, which was called Relay Rights back then, was through an investor friend of mine who was had already invested at Turo. And he wanted me to meet Shelby Clark, the founder of Relay Rights, Turo. And this was in the early summer of 2011. I had just left eBay. I left in April 2011 after 10 years at eBay. I didn't really have any reason to leave, but I really wanted to just take a break. Our twins were 4 or 5 at that time, and I was just on that treadmill for the last 10 plus years. And so I thought I'd just take a one-year sabbatical. I was lucky to be able to do that financially because of the success with iBazaar and the success with eBay. And so, you know, my plan was to be off for a year, do some travel with the family, take care of the kids. I had taken actually 9 months off when the kids were born because my husband was at Berkeley back then, and he was very busy with his studies. And so I took 9 months off, and I was at home for the first 9 months. I realized later, you know, the first 9 months, of course, are very important, but actually it gets more complicated and more interesting and more demanding as they grow up. So I thought I'd take a year off when they were four and, you know, spend time with them and with the family. But shortly after I had quit eBay, a couple of months after I'd quit, one of my friends, Howard, calls me and says, oh, I'd really like you to meet with Shelby. I think what he's doing, you're going to enjoy. And I met with Shelby, and Shelby told me about his vision for the business, a vision that hasn't changed since 2010, 2011. We like to tell the story of our mission as a company as putting the world's 1 billion cars to better use. And he mentioned that to me. I was like, oh my God, of course. You know, it's funny, sometimes you see opportunities and sometimes you just don't see them and they're staring at your face. And after that initial conversation with Shelby, I was just realizing all these cars around me. You know, we get used to them. We're used to this notion that you've got all these cars not being utilized. But if you really think about it, it's just incredible waste. 300 million cars in the U.S., now 1.2 billion cars around the world, the number that keeps on rising. So literally, people invested trillions of dollars in their cars, buy them, and maintain them. For, I think, a utilization rate, at least in the U.S., that's less than 10% of the time. And yet, as you probably know, cars depreciate a lot in value. They cost a lot of money, insurance and parking. And when you look at all of the car-related costs, they're the second line item on an average household, in an average household budget. So a lot of money goes into cars. They lose value. They are heavily underutilized. And I thought, of course, you know, building something like an eBay for cars could be just an incredible opportunity. You know, creating a lot of economic value for people who can suddenly earn money with their cars when they're not using it. So one conversation led to another, and Shelby and Howard convinced me to join as CEO in September 2011, so a little bit over 7.5 years ago. And
how long did that, from the first time you met Shelby to when you agreed to join, how long was that?
3 months.
And what was the conversation that you had with your husband, for instance, coming home? Because you were supposed to be on sabbatical taking care of your kids. So what was the conversation like?
So the one of the reasons why it took 3 months was that we had a camping trip planned, an 8-week camping trip that we had planned as part of my sabbatical and as part of the summer of 2011. That we had really been looking forward to. And there was no question that I was not canceling the camping trip. We had just bought a 2003 Volkswagen Eurovan, the one with the tent. It's a small camper van. And we were determined to go on this, you know, trip with the twins and to visit all of the beautiful national parks. And so when the conversations started getting a bit more engaged with Shelby and Howard. You know, I just sort of quickly told them, listen, if we do this, you know, we're not going to be able to do this anytime soon because I'm going to be out in July and August. And so during that camping trip, we had a lot of time to discuss. we talked a lot about it. And I think my husband Benoit had a big influence on my decision there. And he was now an environmental engineer, and he's very passionate about sustainability and the environment. And
it's very apt.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, amazing kind of how things sometimes come together. So he had been on a family campaign to help us become more sustainable in our house and with our own energy consumption and with recycling and with solar panels and, electric cars and so forth. And so as we were talking about the opportunity, he's like, yes, of course, you must do this. This is a great idea that is going to create a more sustainable future for us as a society. And, we talked a lot about it, and, he was instrumental in sort of pushing me to do it.
So Touro has raised $437 million in funding. As of 2018, there were 300,000 cars listed on the platform, and they had 10 million signups. This is a little bit morbid, but it's instructive, I think. What would be the first two lines of your obituary?
I hadn't thought about this. Maybe I should.
What would you want your three kids to read about their dad?
I would hope that the first two lines would say that I was a great family man, and that I had a positive impact for the people close to me, my family, my friends, but also for positive impact on a bigger circle, and that circle that I feel is a big circle today is the community of users that use Touro. Last year we generated $250 million in revenue, and 60% of that went into the pockets of the car owners that listed their vehicles. And that's a lot of economic empowerment that we've created. And so I love this notion of having positive impact in terms of economic empowerment. There are other wonderful ways to have positive impact. I would like to be remembered as someone who had positive impact on people around him.
What does your dad say now about what you do? What is he? Because he was saying you're crazy for leaving a well-paying job to become an entrepreneur. What does he say? What does he say about what you've become?
So my dad is very stubborn. He still thinks I'm an idiot, and that Touro is a stupid idea, and that it's never going to work.
I have to convince my mother every day what it is that I do as an entrepreneur as well.
This episode was produced by Hiba Fisher and myself, Dana Balut, with editorial support by Lina Muhammad and Alex Atak. Sound design by Muhammad Khreizat and fact-checking by Zena Duwaider. Our original sting was composed by Ramzi Bashur, and El Empire is produced by the Kerning Cultures Network in partnership with Wonder Media Network. A huge thank you, of course, to Andre for giving us his time for this interview. All of our guests are extremely busy people, so it means a lot to us that they trusted us with their time. Thank you, Andre. And next week on El Empire...
The episode went viral. It was everywhere. I started having calls from agents, and I didn't know how to do it. I'm a housewife, minding my own business, doing a PhD. Why are you calling me? I don't know what to do.
That's in 1 week. Lastly, if you are liking El Empire, please subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. Also, leave us a rating and review on whatever podcast app you're listening to us from. Only 5 stars, please. It really helps boost our rankings so that other listeners can find out about us in the podcast libraries. Thank you so much for listening. Have a beautiful day.
Okay, so here's a list of all the people we want to thank who became patrons of Kernan Cultures this month. You guys are awesome, and it's a wonderfully long list. So I'm going to try and sing this for you. Okay. Hassan, Jamil, Paolo, Miriam, Travel, Vince, Rima, Bukor, Latifa, Ahmed, Branca, Laura, Kamal, Catriona, Dana, Beth, Mona, Lucas, Aaron, Laura, Sara, Tracy, Hassan, Nermin, Ahmed, Rosanna, Taimur. Taimur is my brother, by the way. Thank you so much. Dara, who's also a sometimes producer, you're amazing for becoming a patron too. Emily, Sahar, Razan, Peter, Haya, Balsam, Ilian, you guys are awesome. Okay, sorry for subjecting you to that. Thank you all so much, really. You're making the production of these stories possible. Thanks.